Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Feiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Good evening, everyone. Michael Charney. I am in my what has become now, I guess, my home away from home in a hotel in Scarsdale, New York, where I find myself doing a lot of work lately. I am flying solo tonight. Co-host Eric Feiler is, I don't want to say trapped in North Carolina because that sounds terribly wrong, but he's in North Carolina trapped in an area without any kind of decent Wi-Fi signal. So he's if we get lucky, he may find a spot where he can call in, but we're assuming that tonight that I will be running the show pretty much on my own, although I do have a little bit of help tonight. Helping me produce tonight is John Cashon from Paducah, Kentucky. John, first of all, thank you at the last minute for joining us. I appreciate it. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. I feel much better now, much, much better now. Sometimes, as you know, when I'm on the road, any of us on the road, and we this virtual world that we can call in from anywhere and create these radio shows, it's a wonderful thing, but you also are at the mercy of technology, and it's always good to have somebody who's sharing that with you so that if there's any problem with any kind of connections, we know that you're there to help us out. So I appreciate that, John. Thank you very much for joining.
No worries.
Tonight we're going to talk, I hope tonight's show will be a little bit funny, but at the same time serious. We're going to talk a little bit tonight about political humor. I'm going to start because I ran a Facebook post earlier today, and I asked people, and I've invited people tonight as well, to call in or to write on Facebook some of your favorite political jokes. And political humor has a long and storied history, as we'll find it find out in a few minutes. But a couple of them came up, the old standards. One was that I kind of liked was, how many lobbyists does it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer, of course, is zero, because they pay Congress to do it for them. There were a number of sort of the traditional ones like that. Personally, I'm not a big fan of political jokes because they keep getting elected. So, it's for me, it's hopefully it's going to be that kind of a show. I want to re-invite those, anyone listening, and people as they visit the Facebook page. We will be taking some calls later on. Our phone number, as always, area code 646-929-2495. But I'd like to introduce our guest tonight. Our guest is Allison Dagnes, Professor Allison Dagnes from Shippensburg University. And before I bring her on, I just want to tell you, I was in the library about 3 weeks ago, and every once in a while I drop in there and I kind of when I'm just bored with the books that I have at home and I walk around, I can't find anything I want to read, I'll take a trip over to the library and I'll pull half a dozen books off the shelf and I'll take them home and I'll see what hits me. And one of the ones that caught my attention in the nonfiction section was this book called A Conservative Walks into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. And, of course, I read a lot of political books, a lot of books on politics, political theory and political history and political biography. And this one caught my eye because you don't often see books on political humor. As I was looking at the cover, I was recalling an interview that I had. I don't know if it was an interview. Yeah, I guess it was an interview. I believe that Jon Stewart was on Bill O'Reilly. And, of course, they sort of have a love-hate relationship with each other. Jon Stewart calls Bill O'Reilly Papa Bear and credits him with the genesis of the ideas that became The Daily Show, or at least Jon Stewart's version of The Daily Show. And Jon Stewart was going on and on about his approach to humor and how funny was the most important thing, and it seemed to him that there weren't a lot of conservative humorists because for them they weren't starting with the funny, but they were starting with the with the ideology, and that he thought was the wrong way to do humor. And Stewart was going on and on about how he's a humorist first. The joke is the most important thing. And I remember thinking, I'm a moderate Republican, as everybody out there knows, thinking that seemed, I mean, certainly the joke was the most important thing, but the idea that it was so much more important than an agenda caught me a little bit, I felt it was a little bit disingenuous. And I was curious, I saw this book and I was curious to see if, first of all, if it was filled with lots of interesting jokes, and there are some, but only in the context of a far more interesting read, which is really an analysis of why political humor and political satire has sort of evolved the way it has, where it seems like there's so much more of it, that liberals are better versed at it and do more of it, and it seems to fall off quite a bit as you move further and further to the right. I also want to apologize to my audience just for just a quick caveat and a quick apology. We do not always embrace, or we try to stay away from very clear dichotomies of liberal conservative, and we all know that any one individual and anyone's individual's political beliefs are often much more complex than that. But in terms of this particular analysis, it was laid out that way, and in terms of other conversations and other writings that I found in the meantime about political humor, there does seem to be conversation based on the liberal conservative partisan split. So we are going to talk in those kinds of languages, although we respect up front that things are far more complex than that. So with that as introduction, again, I invite anyone to call in if you would like to join the show, 646-929-2495. Just press 1 and let me know you're on hold. If we have the opportunity, also John will sneak off into our little private screening room where he can talk to you and get your name and find out a little bit about what you want to talk about. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and bring in our guest, Allison Dagnes. As I said, Allison is a professor at Shippensburg University in Pennsylvania. She's the author of, in addition to this book that I've mentioned, A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. She's also written a book called Politics on Demand, The Effects of 24-Hour News on American Politics, and a book title, another book on political sex scandals, which I have to say I found the title funny, Allison. I'm going to ask you about it in a minute. The title of the book about political sex scandals is Political Sex Scandals, a Multidisciplinary Approach. And, this all kind of engenders all kinds of images, I think, in my head, most of which I would prefer to get out of there.
No, but hey, the night that Mark Sanford's up for election to South Carolina won, I think this is a good place to jump in.
That's actually a very good point. Although we do want to focus on the humor because that's kind of the topic of tonight. So first of all, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, glad to do it. So tell us a little bit about where your interest in this came from. Why this particular topic? It's not one that you commonly see, and it is an academic analysis, but it's so readable and so fascinating. Please don't take this the wrong way. It doesn't feel like a professor wrote it.
Well, thank you. I mean, I can honestly say thank you for that. I appreciate it. It was such a fun book to write because it came from a truly genuine interest of mine, which was political comedy. I mean, first of all, everybody likes to laugh. I mean, except maybe a couple professors who are my colleagues. But in the main, everybody likes to laugh. And so as I was, I graduated from college as a government major and then was a producer at C-SPAN in the early 1990s, from 1991 to 1996, which was right when Bill Clinton was going through his candidacy and then was president for his first term, and then right up to the second campaign, and where I found sort of really just a joy was in political comedy. And this was where Dana Carvey had his own show. I don't know if anybody remembers that. It was when Dennis Miller was sort of this great stand-up, and he began his own show on HBO. And there was just a lot of political comedy because Clinton was such a big target. And this is way before Lewinsky. I mean, I can speak to the sex scandal because of the second book that I wrote, but But truly, it's before all of that. I mean, we all knew that Clinton was a gigantic target, and comedians had a field day with him. And so where there is a lot of serious and important analysis, there also is a lot of humor. And so I just found, you know, a lot of solace in laughing a great deal. And from there, from C-SPAN, I went to graduate school, I got a job at Chippensburg, and I have always studied media. And one of the things that I found very, very informative and very important in the last 5 to 10 years was how important satire has become. Because truthfully, where in the 1990s cable was emerging, in the 2000s really Comedy Central was emerging. And so from there came Jon Stewart and then Stephen Colbert. And my students began to say, you know, we really watch that as much as we watch the news. Not instead of, but as much as we watch. And I thought, okay, there's something there. And this great guy from North Carolina named Jody Baumgartner did this sort of formative study on The Daily Show and what you can learn from The Daily Show. And I read that academic paper and thought, okay, we can really do more here. And because, as my husband says, it's better to be lucky than good, I happened to grow up with a good friend who is an improv artist named Rachel Hamilton, and she went up through Second City with a bunch of comedians, and she was able to connect me with a bunch of them. I interviewed them, and that's how the book came about.
That's interesting. And by the way, yeah, the book is filled with interviews and anecdotes. And you know, Luce Black, Jimmy Tingle, Nick DiPaolo.
Mm-hmm.
I the names go on and on. It really is quite impressive. Will Durst, who I adore. So it's interesting. Growing up, I remember, for example, even Rich Little, right, doing
sure.
Political impressions, although it was pretty tame by today's standards. But we had Richard Pryor was certainly doing political stuff. George Carlin.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. I sort of bookend my memories of political humor because I've always had a fondness for it. To being in when I was in probably junior high, and I got a copy of Class Clown, George Carlin's I think second or third
sure.
album. And it was the point in Carlin's career where he moved away from sort of the silliness of, you know, the hippy-dippy weatherman and all of that kind of stuff and actually started talking more about language, which is inherently political. But I remember a routine he did on Muhammad Ali, talking about how the government basically told Muhammad Ali, for those who don't remember or never learned this part of history, was stripped of his heavyweight title because he refused to be drafted. And I honestly don't remember if he spent any time in prison or not, but he was stripped of his title. And I remember Carlin's whole routine around the government having a conversation with Muhammad Ali, basically saying, Muhammad Ali saying, I don't want to kill people. And the government saying, well, if you don't want to kill them, we're not going to let you beat them up. And that, I remember that very distinctly, that line and how he did it. And then on the other end, you've got Tina Fey just nailing Sarah Palin in a lot of ways. And is it really the rise of cable? Because he certainly, you know, your Carlins and your Richard Pryors and even before that your Lenny Bruce's and your Dick Gregory's, certainly political comedy is not new and political satire is not new. Why is it really just the media explosion that has made it so available, that's made it so important today?
Well, it's a great question. Certainly you have hit upon something that's very, very important, which is that satire is an outsider art. And so it is supposed to take down sacred cows. And in the 1960s, which was a revolutionary period, satire and political comedy was especially fecund. I mean, this was a really rich time, because the establishment was so ripe for the pickings. And so when you had that period, that's when the Smothers Brothers were on television with the Comedy Hour. And, you know,
yeah.
and they were just really poking the eye of everybody at CBS saying, you know, hey, we are going to absolutely get you. And we don't care what you do. It was a ripe time for that. And so what I really found is that political comedy waxes and wanes with the political culture of the time. And so when we are, as a nation, very, very scared or very, very patriotic, comedy doesn't work as well. And if you look, you know, sort of in the middle of World War II, for example, or right after September 11th, you know, right after September 11th, somebody proclaimed that irony was dead. You know, I mean, that's a really big proclamation, but that was when John Stewart...
And somewhat ironic.
quite, but at the time it wasn't. You know, at the time it wasn't. And if you look back at the Onion and the headlines that it did and the stories that it did, if you look back at The Daily Show, I mean, this was not irony. I mean, this was mourning. And there wasn't... There might have been a smiling through the tears, but it really was not particularly like waka waka funny, nor was it really taking down the establishment. And that's because we as a nation were in this period of sadness. And so I think that comedy really reflects how we feel as a nation. And once the nation got beyond the September 11th fear, you know, that's when John Stewart really began to get his sea legs under him. I mean, that's when he really started sort of picking apart everybody, and the nation turned to him and said, wow, you're really good at this media analysis, which is what he's excellent at. Less so the political, more so the media criticism. And so that's really where he began to be fantastic. So, you know, satire is supposed to take down all of these establishment figures, and that's really the idea of it, the jester mocking the king. It can be used to educate, but the truth of the matter is that comedy is supposed to be this very fluid sort of duck and pivot sort of art. And if you come at it with this idea of like, okay, I'm going to make a point, you know, it's going to be less funny than if you just sort of react, which is why I think that so many, and one of the chapters I do in the book is to say, look, these folks are performing arts people. I mean, none of the people I interviewed, and I interviewed 34 comedians, none of whom are political scientists. None of whom.
Yeah, I found that very interesting. You go into the book a bit, and I'd like you to talk about what is it that sort of ripens somebody into being in this line of work.
Because I think that they wanted to make people laugh first, and I think that the political part of it came second. And so as a result, you know, I know a lot of political people. When you are a political person, the genesis of what you're doing starts from a really different place. I mean, you feel it. You know, you are a Kool-Aid drinker. You are ready to go at it. You are, you know, your fisticuffs blaring. As opposed to a comedian who really wants the laugh, who really wants the approval of the audience, that's a very different starting point. And so my research interest right now is how politicians use humor in their speeches, and that is a very, very, very different starting point than where.
Yeah, that is interesting. I've noticed recently, because of course we just had the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Correspondents' Dinner, exactly. Yeah.
And I saw clips of it almost immediately after I had finished reading your book, and I was watching Obama in a different way, and he's pretty good. He delivers a line pretty well.
He's
not all
very good at it.
Certainly, George W. Bush did not at all. He didn't have the kind of delivery to do that. But it is interesting how politicians use it. And it seemed to me that the politicians who have used some humor, and not long ago, Chris Christie was after Hurricane Sandy. Chris Christie was on Saturday Night Live wearing the now infamous sweatshirt. It seems to me that politicians can pull it off pretty much only if they're self-deprecatory. They can't really go on the offensive and be funny. Is that
No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And what I'm looking at right now is the kind of joke that a politician can make. And he can be self-deprecatory. He can be mocking of another party's general platform, but not anything really policy-specific. And he can also be mocking of a person's physical characteristic, and that's about it. Because anything more than that is really too harming. I mean, where a comedian makes his bread and butter is to kind of bring everybody into the joke and say, ha, 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 aren't they all awful? And when a politician tries to do that, he's going to offend a large number of people because the all is a much smaller group of people.
Right.
You know, I mean, when a comedian says, oh, aren't they all awful, he's talking about Congress. He's talking about, you know, presidents and the executive branch. You know, I mean, he's talking about a large group of people. When
the power structure, the institution.
Exactly. And by the way, that's an easy narrative to feed into because most people don't understand the political system. And so if you say, you know what, Congress is a, you know, a bunch of asshats and they don't understand what they're doing, then everybody around me will nod and go, yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah. True. If you say, okay, the Republicans are at fault because they have a misconception about the function of government, and when they say that the preamble really speaks only to the police state and, you know, defense. Yeah, exactly. I mean, okay, how much more do I have to feed you before
exactly.
you get a joke? Yeah, and that's what Lewis Black was saying. Like, when you have to set up a joke that much, it's not that funny anymore.
Right.
And I interviewed this guy from SiriusXM, Pete Dominic, who does a show called Stand Up, and he's a stand-up comedian. He's great. He said that even with someone who, you know, today, Mark Sanford, we're talking about, he said even Mark Sanford, when you try and talk about him, even though he's a national figure who's a laughingstock because he is a target of, you know, sexual, you know, chicanery, you still have to set it up to the point that people will start snoring. And Mark Maron, when I interviewed him, said, look, 90% of the time, people's eyes are going to roll into the back of their heads. They don't care about politics. They don't. And so, you know, I mean, there's, you know, there's a certain amount of like, oh, waka waka, you know, Republicans have vests and monocles and money bags and aren't they funny? You know, okay, that's great. You know, but anything more than that, you know, you get into like, okay, the differences between our concepts of Social Security or, God forbid, the, you know, Affordable Care Act, like, you know, I don't think so. You know, it just is a non-starter. And so
right.
it's really hard to be a political comedian in today's age.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't really thought about that because I've always had an interest in politics and I have an incredible love of language. And one of the places where language is twisted and deformed more than perhaps anywhere else in our culture is in politics. So the two have always gone together for me. And so I've never particularly had difficulty keeping up with the joke. I mean, you can do jokes on sequesters, and I know what the sequester is, and you can do jokes on, you know, lots of arcana, political arcana, and I'll get it. And so I don't really see it, but I see your point, that there's a lot of people who are just, you know, are looking for those, you know, the jokes about the man-woman relationship jokes is what they go out to the comedy clubs to hear about, not necessarily the political humor.
But let me ask you a question. I mean, if
sure.
if you are going to make a joke about the sequester, who are you telling it to?
you know, honestly, mostly to amuse myself. But no, I'm saying that with some seriousness. I'll joke around the house and play with language and whatever, and it's mostly just to see if I could pull it off. But it is an interesting question. In theory, I'm making the joke when I'm in the company of other people who I know are also interested politically. So, you
but
know,
are
I can
they
make a joke on a coffee party board call or when I'm with my friends, you know, Kath and Dave in New Hampshire talking about the Sunday morning political shows. But I'm not going to just sort of blurt out a sequester joke with, you know, somebody down the hall in my office or something like that necessarily.
Are they going to be of like mind of you? I mean, politically.
Some will and some won't. But I don't know if this is where you're going, but I'm not likely to use any kind of political humor in an environment where I don't know the people.
And I think, I think that sort of speaks to a lot of political comedy, is that you know, one of the things that the comedians that I interviewed said was, when you go political, you're going to offend half your audience. I mean, just by virtue of who our country is.
Sure.
And so why do it? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, why would you go out there if you knew that if whatever you said would offend half of your radio audience right now, would you do it?
Probably not. But see, okay. That brings up in my opening monologue, I brought this point up, and this is why I thought when Jon Stewart says, you know, he's a comedian. I get that he's basically a comedian, and his job is to be funny, and it's an entertainment show. There's no question about that. But he clearly knows, as a political humorist, that he's also got that issue, and he knows who his audience is and the demographics of his show, which definitely lean left. So that's why I say, isn't it, if a political humorist sort of by definition must have some kind of an agenda, don't you think? Otherwise, if you were just a humorist and you wanted to please as many people as possible, you wouldn't pick politics to make jokes about for the reason you just described. So don't you find it a little also disingenuous when
oh, that's brilliant. No, that's so brilliant. You are very, 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 very wise. Okay, so...
No, keep going. I want to hear more.
Okay. Yes, you're extremely smart and obviously very good looking.
Thank you.
Okay, so two thoughts about that. First of all, Jay Leno speaks to as many people as humanly possible, according to his writers. I mean, if he tells a Republican joke, he'll tell a Democratic joke. And the easiest jokes are the jokes that are about the sex scandals and the easy-to-hang-your-hat-on narratives, and all he wants is one more viewer. And so there's that. But your point is extremely well taken as to why you would even venture a toe into this water knowing that you're going to offend a lot of people. And I think that, you know, that the vast, vast majority of political comedians who do this knowing exactly who their audience is and what it is they want. And so I can't use names, but I very briefly interviewed a person who was a booker at a huge comedy club in Los Angeles, and said, hey, I'm writing this book on political comedy, and do you book political comedians? And he said, no, I really don't. And I said, great, I want to interview you. And then he put me off. And then at South by Southwest, he held a panel as to why he does not book political comedians, and it was the premise of my book. I thought, you turkey. You are an awful person. But his point was very well taken, which was that the 9 times out of 10, when you're talking pure stand-up, no. I mean, political comedy is really not very highly booked. There's no point to it. You're really going to offend a lot of people. 9 times out of 10, the people who stumble into a comedy club are there for the dick jokes, and that is a direct quote. And so why even bother? No, that said... If you look at
I read that in your book as well, and I'm not, and it wasn't crystalline to me as to what that means to a comedian.
Oh, I mean, that means literally like, I'm going to tell a sex joke right now, sex joke, dick joke, and then we'll get back to political. I mean, it'll be like, women, huh? You know, I mean, it'll be that kind of thing.
Oh, so it's really quite literal, okay.
Yeah, I mean, literally a dick joke. I mean, it just is not. There's nothing sort of subtle about it.
I want you to know, Allison, you're the very first person on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network who's ever used that phrase. So.
I feel honored. Thank you so much. Anytime you need somebody to come on and say dick joke, I'm here for you. Now,
okay,
that said, you know, stand-up is very different than what Jon Stewart does and what, you know, even the people at NPR do. And I interviewed Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Wonderful humorist.
Oh, God, he's so great. And he, you know, what he said was, we take a funny slant of the news, and that's what the people at The Daily Show do. That's what the people at Colbert do. They just take a funny slant on it. And so, interestingly, I have this great undergraduate who named Chris Sylvia, who was just, we were just up in Portland, Maine, your neck of the woods, and he presented some original research that he did, and what he found is exactly in line with what I did, which was that you know, the truth of the matter is, you know, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and The Daily Show and everything else that sort of pokes fun at politics in any kind of mainstream media way, really the way that they do it is the same kind of gatekeeping as any of the news programs, only they're looking for the funny. They're not looking for the ideological. They're not trying to make some sort of big political point about the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. They're trying to get the laugh because they are entertainers first. And so as the staff of The Daily Show is gatekeeping and trying to sort through the news in order to get the humor, it's the, you know, the same thing's going on, you know, 20 blocks over at Fox News headquarters on Avenue of the Americas in New York City, trying to get the, okay, we're going to make liberals look like asshats. Same thing goes on five blocks away at MSNBC, at 30 Rock, to say, you know, okay, we're going to make conservatives look really douchey. And it's the same thing. I mean, it's right. It's just what gatekeeping, you know, which gates are you opening and closing? And for the folks at Comedy Central, it's the humor. For the folks at Fox, it's conservative. For the folks at MSNBC, it's liberal. It really just depends on what it is you're looking for. But that's what they look for, and that's what they do.
So let's talk for a minute about the elephant that's not in the corner. Not in the corner. You open your book basically saying, you sort of challenge the reader to name any other conservative satirist, political satirist, other than the two major names, Dennis Miller and P.J. O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the challenge, and I actually had to go hunting to find out. You also, as you go into the book, well, I immediately came up with the name Nick DiPaolo because just because of where he is. And
so
I find
great.
Him hysterical.
I love Nick.
I knew that name as well. And you know, if I catch a stand up bit with him on television or on one of those cable shows, I'm stuck. I think he's very funny. Beyond that, I too had a great deal of difficulty. The only name, and I knew there was a guy, but I didn't know his name. This is the comedian who does the BS of A, which is now on Glenn Beck's Blaze Network. His name is Brian Sack. I don't know if you're familiar with Brian Sack or not.
No, I'm not.
So, yeah, and he was the only other one that I could think of, and he has a reasonably large following because he basically was protégé by Glenn Beck. And I've seen him do some stuff, and he can be pretty even-handed. He can be all over the map. It's supposed to be sort of like Glenn Beck's answer to The Daily Show. It's nowhere near in that league. But clearly the guy is a conservative political satirist, and he's got a reasonable following. After that, apart from Beck himself, who if you go back to some of his, you know, he actually did a comedy tour back in 2009, and he can be incredibly funny doing stand-up as a conservative political humorist. I don't know if you've caught any of his stuff. But it's a shame that that's not what he does for a living, because he'd be really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
We'd all enjoy him a lot more. But I couldn't name any. So why is that? Why, you know, we asked this question on Facebook, and I'll tell you, you get some of the unfortunate and traditional sort of answers. You know, the conservatives have no sense of humor. Conservatives have their heads up their asses. You can't, you know, how can you make, in order to make fun of something, you have to understand the facts behind it, and Republicans don't believe the facts, and you know, the usual kind of stuff.
Sure.
That we get used to sometimes.
Sure.
But what do you, what's your answer to that? Why aren't there more? Why aren't there elephants in the corner?
Well, it's such a good question. I found a couple things. First of all, it depends what you put first. And to me, one of the reasons that I had an entire chapter devoted to what was your major in college was because I interviewed all these people. I was a producer at C-SPAN for 5 years, and so I got to watch Brian Lamb, who absolutely no offense intended to you. I mean, Brian is just sort of the best interviewer in the world. And what he would always ask people, just to get them sort of softened up, was, where'd you go to college? What was your major? And so I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And after the first 10 interviews that I did, I thought, oh, my God, they're all performing arts majors. Like, that's amazing. And so that led me to something. And what that led me to was that they're not really, that these political comedians who were doing most of the political comedy, they were not really political. And so I think that what that then led me to was the idea that what was most important to a comedian was a comedy. So if you start with what is funny, then you will end with what is funny. If you start with, I'm going to prove a point, I'm going to make a point, I'm going to change your mind, then you might do that, but it ain't going to be funny along the way. And so I think that for the vast majority of the people that I interviewed, they didn't really care about changing people's minds. They cared about making people laugh. And that is a very liberal concept. You know,
okay, so you're going to have to drill down on that one.
Okay,
I've been told I have a decent sense of humor. And,
I certainly
appreciate a lot of this humor. I mentioned I watched The Daily Show, and we'll talk about Colbert in a few minutes as an act unto himself. But I consider myself right of center. I mean, I am right of center. So why do you say this is a liberal place to come from?
Because it's an outsider art, because you're taking down the establishment. And you as a conservative could want to take down Obama, but that's not the establishment. That's not wanting to progress things. That's not wanting to change things. Comedy is saying, like, look, this is what's really screwed up, and this is what we want to change. And that's not really conservative conceit.
Okay,
you know?
I'll accept that, yes.
Okay.
I agree. It's not...
And by the way, I am absolutely not saying that conservatives cannot be funny. I mean,
Oh, well, that's good.
Oh, my gosh. I pray to Nick DiPaolo. I think Nick DiPaolo is just, a really funny guy. I mean, he made me laugh so hard that I had to move away from the microphone because I was laughing so hard I thought it was going to show up on tape. I mean, he is a very, very funny guy. And then he did a show with me in New York that was so good, and he's so bright, and he's able to do that kind of like duck and pivot thing that a lot of liberal comedians can do. The problem is when you're that, you know, to be conservative is I mean, the literal conceit of conservative is to conserve. I mean, you don't really want to change all that much. And so what's funny about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting to say that. I just want to respond. We'll have this dialogue for a minute or two, and then I want to take a call before we go on to talking about Stephen Colbert as a personal interest of mine. There are institutions that that are traditionally liberal institutions that could be the subject of conservative satire. So one of them, for example, and I mentioned that I ran across this clip earlier tonight from Glenn Beck's Common Sense Comedy Tour from 2009. And he does this very, very funny routine about getting people to come to one of his rallies. And I guess around that time he was doing the, I don't know if it was the Restore Courage or the Restore, I don't know, it was one of his Restore tours. I think it was the first one. And he does this long extended routine about, you know, the conservatives don't want to get up and they're going to have to paint the signs, and why can't they get union guys to paint the signs, but then union guys might stop right in the middle, and then you'll have a sign that just says stop, and we don't know what we want to stop. And I'm not doing it justice. I was howling, and I'm not a Glenn Beck fan. And so I think about unions, for example. I think about the stereotypes around liberal education is another example. There are things like, I mean, you could even in the areas of religion, you could, there's certainly humor around things like Unitarian Universalist churches. There are institutions that that would be, you know, some sense of some kind of power structure that conservatives could go after, and yet it doesn't seem to happen. And so I'm wondering if it isn't more of a chicken and egg question that you need to, you know, the kind of training, sorry, I'm going on and on with this question, the kind of training that you need to be able to do this well and the desire to do it well comes out of a liberal arts background. Is it in fact liberal-minded people who are attracted to liberal arts backgrounds in the first place to ever get the training to kick off into that world? Because I don't 100% buy that there aren't institutions and power structures that conservatives could make fun of.
Well, I think you're onto something. I think that a liberal arts education certainly is a riper field for training. And I think that conservatives are, for whatever reason, perhaps dissuaded from being in those liberal arts fields. And you know what, I see that in political science. I mean, I really do. So I think you might be onto something there. But I also think that, you know, the conservative comedians that I interviewed really identified as libertarian. And I think that is a very outsider perspective. And I think that fits far more than conservative philosophy, which is this idea of sort of, you know, I want a house with a dog and a car in the garage and the, you know, the job and everything and the, you know, the political system that's going to give me my tax breaks. There's not much funny about that. If you start picking apart the entire political system, which libertarians do and which liberals do for very different reasons, you know, I think that there's more humor there. You know, political comedy is really this real outsider art. I mean, it's observational, it's critical, and it aims at all moving targets. And when you are entrenched in the system and when you say, the system is good for me and I want to support the system, then making fun of the system isn't really all that funny. If you say the system is all screwed up and I'm going to take it down, then there's a lot to poke holes in. And so I think that's libertarian and liberalism sort of right there, as opposed to conservatism and communitarian.
Interesting. I want to take a call. We've had somebody who's been holding for a bit now. And then I want to come back and talk about a couple of other things, in particular pain and suffering and the role that plays as well. Jonathan Haidt a little bit. For those of you who haven't read Jonathan Haidt or heard anything about him, we'll introduce him in a minute as well. I'm gonna take a moment to push somebody else's book on your time because it's worth it.
It's so worth it. So true.
The big one. This idea of bias and the whole argument around bias. But first, we have a caller who's been very, very patient. Again, if you'd like to call in and join the show, we're talking tonight with Allison Dagnus, who's written a wonderful analysis of political humor called A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. You can reach The Middle Ground, as always, on area code 646-929-2495. You can press 1 on your phone, and that way we'll know on our boards. John will know that you're waiting to speak with us, and he can find out a little bit about you in our private screening room, and then we can bring you on to the show. But for now, I'd like to bring on board area code 707 from California. I noticed you've been waiting for a while, and you've dropped off and come back on a couple of times, so I appreciate your patience. Area code 707, welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Mark, and I'm calling from Runner Park in California.
Welcome to the show, Mark. Do you have a question for Allison?
Well, sort of a question and a comment. I was listening to your conversation. I did drop off a couple times, but I thought it was very interesting to hear that most of the comedians that she interviewed were performing arts majors. And I think a lot of that has to do with to be a successful performing arts person, you have to know your audience. You have to know what they are expecting. You have to know what they think and feel so you know how to time your reaction, to time your topic, pick your topic. And that sounded very interesting when you were talking about how you guys don't see as many conservative comedians, and it may be that there are more specifics with regard to the specific policy details or something like that. But you're saying that liberal arts majors aren't typically conservative. So it may be that there's just more training going to liberals more so than conservatives. And so you find an aggregate of more liberal comics.
No, I think that's a really, really good point. You have to sort of wonder what kind of person is attracted to the performing arts. And I teach at a liberal arts college in the middle of South Central Pennsylvania, and most of my students are conservative. And so we have a huge business school, and we have a huge education school. And our College of Arts and Sciences is, you know, a formidable college, but it also sort of begs the question of how many English majors do we have, how many history majors, how many political science majors. And the truth of the matter is business and teacher ed, you know, they just far outnumber us. And that is because I really believe that where you stand politically is in line with what it is you want to do and how it is you want to be and what it is you want in this world. And so when I will say to a particularly gifted political science major who happens to be conservative, you know, hey, we could really use you in the academy. You should think about coming back for a graduate degree, maybe, you know, a PhD in political science. And they will say, okay, what does it take? And I'll say, okay, here's the good news. You go for free. You don't have to pay for it. And they say, okay, great. How long does it take? And I say, 7 years. And they say, nope, not interested. I want to go make money. I want a dog and a house and a car and a picket fence and a desk and a lamp. And that's what I want. That, to me, is a very conservative conceit. You know, not this idea that, you know, academics are so liberal and freaky and weird, but that they don't want to spend 7 years of their life, you know, sort of examining little T truth and capital T truth. You know, they really just want to go out and sort of be. And I think that that really speaks to sort of the conservative mind and liberal mind, which is where Jonathan Haidt did some fantastic research out of UVA. These ideas of who we are and what we believe in, I really think that that sort of speaks volumes to the directions that we go in as people. And so a more liberal person, it's not that they're smarter. I'm not saying liberals are smarter and they can duck and pivot and do, you know, everything that liberals do. It's just this idea that, you know, okay, we'll spend 7 years sort of looking at different facets of things and come away with a varying degree of capital T and lowercase t truths, you know, and conservatives just don't want to do that. There's no good or bad, there just is. And so I don't think that conservatives are dissuaded from being in the liberal arts. I think that they aren't attracted to it to begin with because of who they are. And I think that that's fine. But I think that also
that's
lends
itself
to...
Certainly the topic of what kinds of careers and majors attract people of different political persuasions. If you have, if you have some references on that, it's not the topic of tonight's show. I don't want to go down that path. But for my own edification, if you could, you know, email me or Facebook me a couple of references to that, I'd be really interested in reading a bit about that as well.
Oh, I'd be happy to. And really, yeah. the Jonathan Haidt book, Haidt, is really just a great place to start. I mean, this is a guy who's done all of the research in this area, and he really can sort of speak to this and in a very authoritative manner. I think you'll like it. It's very accessible.
Yes. Oh, no, I agree. First of all, Mark, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. I do want to talk about Jonathan Haidt and his influence on your book. It was when I read your book. So Jonathan Haidt is, for our audience, a moral psychologist out of, I guess, he did work at UVA. I don't know if he's still there or not. And he wrote a book called The Righteous Mind. And I forget the subtitle. It's actually, I'm in the middle of reading it. It's across the room from me right now, but I have to get off the line in order to go get it.
No,
so,
that's okay. Can I drop a name to make your audience want it more? The person that actually led me to Jonathan Haidt was Keegan-Michael Key, as in Key and Peele on Comedy Central right now. And when I interviewed Keegan, he was like, oh, my God, you have to look up Jonathan Haidt. And he spelled it for me. And we had like this hour and 45-minute long conversation about Jonathan Haidt. I mean, Keegan was the only person who I interviewed who had a graduate degree. Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? Lewis Black did, master's in fine arts. But he and Keegan were the only people who had graduate degrees. And Keegan was like, oh, my God, you got to check this guy out. He's so genius. And so I did. And I'm so glad that Keegan pointed me in this direction because he is fantastic. And he speaks directly to this idea of sort of liberal groups and conservative groups moving in different directions in terms of career trajectory and moral ideas and what's funny and what's not. I mean, it's really wonderful. I really recommend all of your listeners to check it out.
I absolutely concur. So, you know, as I said, I had picked up Haidt's book a while ago, and it had been sitting on my shelf. And it was one of those I just hadn't gotten around to. And one of them that I passed by when I decided to go to the library because there wasn't anything I was in the mood to read in the house, and picked up your book. And you mentioned Haidt only briefly. I think you do a short piece on him about two-thirds of the way through the book. And maybe it sunk in somehow, but as soon as I was done with your book, I was reattracted to go pick up that book, and I've been reading that one since. So for our audience, just very simply, Haidt is a moral psychologist, and he talks about five flavors or five tastes of moral intuition, and he uses a number of analogies, but in this particular analogy, he likens it to like taste buds. You have different flavors of moral intuition, and he has sort of dichotomous pairs. So there's harm and care, for example, and there's, without going into a lot of details, there's something around fairness, there's something around loyalty, there's something around authority, and there's something around sanctity. And there's a sixth one, which I'll save for a moment. But he basically talks about when he looks at the kinds of things that trigger those various flavors of moral intuition, that people who identify themselves as being liberal are very, very highly activated on things like care and fairness, less so on loyalty, authority, and sanctity or religiosity, whereas conservatives tend to be kind of balanced across the five, nowhere near as high on fairness and caring as liberals, but much higher on loyalty, authority, and sanctity, whereas liberals in general aren't triggered by loyalty, authority, and sanctity at all. And I think you make the case, I'll let you make it yourself, but that played into your analysis of why liberals are more likely to do political humor than conservatives. Can you explain that a little? Because this is a fascinating model.
Sure. I mean, I really think that that there is a, you know, I was interviewing Will Durst, who's a fairly well-regarded political comedian. And what he was saying was that in order to do this, you have to really be able to duck and weave, you know, sort of very quickly. And I remember seeing Will Durst in the 1990s, and he would have a thing where he called out to the audience and said, okay, I'm going to talk about old music shows, and you're gonna throw me sort of new music groups and tell me, you know, how they compare. And so I remember him being able to very quickly sort of pivot. And one person said, okay, you know, here's the modern group is Alice in Chains. What's the old group? And he said, the Kinks. And I remember thinking, like, wow, that was really quick. You know, that was very, very able of you to take something new and turn it into something that you could understand very, very quickly. And when I interviewed him, he said that that was really the job of the political comedian, was to be able to take things in and turn it around very easily, and to be able to not sort of break where you had to bend. And I think that that speaks to a liberal mind. And I'm not saying, please, you know, conservatives, do not say that I'm saying you're unintelligent, you're not facile. But I do think that conservatives really have an idea about morality, they have an idea about what is right is what is wrong, whereas liberals are far more flexible on that. And so there is this idea in the liberal mind of, okay, we're going to be moral relativists, you know, that maybe if you're Anthony Weiner and you tweeted out pictures of your junk to people, you know, maybe that isn't really cheating on your wife. You know, your wife stayed with you. We're willing to bend, as opposed to the conservative mind, which is, you know, okay, you done wrong and we're going to excommunicate you. Although apparently that's not the case in Mark Sanford, who apparently just won South Carolina one.
Yes,
but,
that's
you know,
weird.
I mean, oh my God. Okay, so, you know, so apparently there is this, you know, sort of black and white to conservatism that is not the case with liberalism. And I think that, therefore, it lends itself to a more comedic idea of what is good and what is bad and what is funny and what is not funny. And what I heard over and over again from all of these writers was, you know, in the writer's room, everything is fair game. And if you're going to be easily offended, then you don't belong there. And I live around a bunch of conservatives who are amazing. And these are the people that I want watching my children. You know, I don't necessarily want moral relativists keeping an eye out for my kids. I want the people who are going to look at this in black and white. But they're not funny. I mean, they're not funny at all. And this is sort of the land where irony went to die. And so, you know, you have to sort of balance the two. And I think that that's okay. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I do think you have to acknowledge where the humor comes from. And these days, humor comes from a very leftist, educated, 40-something pool of talent that tends to be more male than not, tends to be more white than not. And that's where political comedy really emerges from. And if you look at who the sort of the big guys are, you know, I don't think Jay Leno's a big guy in political comedy, and he's really on his way out. I think you're looking at your Jon Stewart, your Stephen Colbert, your Conan, maybe Jimmy Kimmel, maybe Jimmy Fallon, and you're really looking at a bunch of sort of educated white guys in their 40s who have writers who are along those lines, and they're funny, and they're facile, and they are well-educated, and they can turn a phrase better than I certainly can. I mean, by a lot. But, you know, that's who you're getting your political comedy from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I, you know, you mentioned Colbert. You mentioned it a couple times. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is I remember in Stewart's interview with O'Reilly, Stewart sort of kind of softly poo-pooed the idea that he was really influential, that he really was having any kind of an impact.
Yeah, he's lying.
I think you're right. I don't think he's that stupid or normally that disingenuous.
No.
But when you get to Colbert, that's a whole different universe of impact. I mean, Colbert is one of these guys who's taken political humor and moved it into the quote unquote real world in a very big way. And the reason I got it just very briefly for those of you who know, when Chasing Glenn Beck was first released, which was my first book.
I read that.
Did you read it?
I did, and I read the Colbert thing about it. That was fantastic. Good for you.
Well, thank you very much. so the a portion of the proceeds initially went to Colbert's Super PAC, and because I felt that it was just a marvelous twist of the universe that he was taking the irony of this and putting it out there in the real world and using it to make the kind of point that exactly what he was doing was what we should not be allowing anyone to do.
Right.
First of all, I couldn't think of any other examples in my limited knowledge of the subject that was even close to having that kind of an impact. Maybe, you know, Dick Gregory and getting arrested and those kinds of things. But do you think that's the role of humorists? Do you think Colbert's in a class by himself, or do you think he represents sort of a new wave of humorist activism, if you will? Because he's an activist, there's no question.
Well, here's kind of my thing. First of all, I think it's fantastic that you did what you did. And so my hat really goes off to you. First of all, it was a great book. And so anybody who's listening who hasn't bought it really needs to, because it was so much fun. But it was, you know, what a great thing to support a great conceit, which is this idea that Colbert is going to use satire to directly instruct the American public as to how pernicious super PACs are. I mean, it's just what a, you know, genius, 18 kinds around. So, you know, hat goes off to everybody, because anything that you could do to kind of say, like, oh my gosh, look at this is amazing. Truth be told, Stewart, more so than Colbert, they are not in the business of educating. And here's where, you know, Jon Stewart, you know, who's been on the cover of Rolling Stone, who's hosted the He hosted the Oscars, and Colbert hosted the Correspondents' Dinner with a resounding thunk.
Yes.
I mean, these folks, you know, these folks have invaded the castle, and you know, and they're running the joint, and that's great.
But
for them.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Let's not forget Colbert testified before Congress in character.
He did. Yes, he did.
I think you actually mentioned that in your book as well.
I did,
and
I show it to my students.
That's taking it to a whole different level.
But you see, here's the thing. First of all, the two are doing very different things. You know, Jon Stewart as a fake news guy who was ranked as the most trusted news guy, that's a really different thing than Stephen Colbert, who does pure satire. And I really genuinely feel for Stephen Colbert. And I've met both of them, and Stephen Colbert may be the nicest person walking the face of the planet. I mean, he just is a total frickin' mensch. One of his favorite songs is one of my favorite songs from Ben Folds, The Best Imitation of Myself. And I see why, because the poor guy, I mean, he now has to lead this life that is 180 away from who he actually is. And so that's really different than what Jon Stewart does. I mean, Jon Stewart sort of takes a stick and pokes at the eye of the media establishment, and he does it in a really great way. When he is interviewed, however, and he says, you know, everybody else does infotainment, we just do tainment, it's disingenuous because he knows how influential he is, and he's no dummy. Now, that said, if you were to actually get Jon Stewart to acknowledge how influential he is, it changes his mission. It changes his goal. And more important than that, it changes his jokes. Because if he's the guy who's in charge of teaching you something, you're screwed. You know, and so is he. Because his joke writers, and he's got a staff of 14, you know, they're there not to teach you something. I mean, they're not professors. They're there to make you laugh. And so as the gatekeeping function is there, as my student presented last weekend, you know, that's great. They may teach you something. That's not what their job is. And that's not why they're on Comedy Central. And so that's Jon Stewart. Now, Stephen Colbert has a much more difficult job ahead of him, which is to really poke at the punditry that has taken over cable news. And that's much more difficult, because I interviewed his former executive producer, and actually one of the people who was there at the founding, this great, 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 super smart woman named Allison Silverman. And what she said was that writing for Colbert was like driving down the highway going backwards, because just when you think you want to turn right, you want to turn left. And what she meant was that the point of Colbert, because he's supposed to be the sort of lovable idiot making fun of Bill O'Reilly, was to say, like, okay, I'm going to bloviate in this conservative way, and I'm going to show you how dumb it is without actually seeming dumb. And that's that's pure satire. It's using the opposite of what you mean to say in order to prove your point.
It's really
super difficult to do. Yeah, I mean, that's just tough.
Yeah.
And it's
interesting, though, you also mentioned in the book that that he has an audience from both sides of the spectrum, and that liberals see it, and it's kind of no other way to phrase it, but liberals get the joke, and conservatives find it funny because they don't get the joke, and they think to some degree he's making fun of liberals.
Yes. A great researcher named Heather Lamar out of Ohio State University did a huge study that showed that a significant number of people, evenly divided between liberals and conservatives, the conservatives did not get the joke and the liberals did. But what this really proved more than anything was confirmation bias, which is the idea that you're going to agree with things that agree with you. And I think that really, you know, I think that is really informative. I think it's really important that, you know, I begin my book talking about how in love I was with Dennis Miller, and I really, really was.
As
and
was
then,
I.
Oh, he's so great. And if you listen to his stuff in the 1990s, which I did rather obsessively, when he turned sort of hard pro George W. Bush, right, like I will be on Fox News on Wednesday nights, kind of right, I really listened to him and I thought, okay, just turn me into a believer. Turn me into a believer. And he couldn't. And so part of it, I think, was that he was approaching it from an ideological standpoint, which he had not before. And part of it was my own, and I will own this, my own confirmation bias, which is not this, I mean, I'm not some, you know, sort of hard lefty liberal person, but the things that he was making fun of as somebody who, I think, if you call yourself sort of center-right, I would call myself center-left, I didn't think were particularly funny. And I know that part of that was on me, and part of that was on him. Because if his joke is like, ugh, liberals are stupid, and everybody laughs, and I don't laugh, I don't think it's particularly great. But it also could be that he's making fun of who I am. And so I think that we get to sort of share the blame there. And so that's where, you know, that's where I lost Dennis Miller, and I wish that I didn't, because I do think that he can really turn a phrase sort of better than many, many people, because I think he's hyper bright. I just wish he would start out with the idea of, like, I'm going to go with what's funny as opposed to what is ideologically pure.
I think that's very interesting. And Miller actually makes an interesting case study because, and you describe yourself in your book as being left of center. I'm right of center. And my experience with Miller was almost exactly the same as yours. I fell in love with Dennis Miller for two reasons. One is his ability to use language in brilliant,
ways.
Oh,
so good, wasn't he? Oh, my God.
And secondly, his willingness to assume the intelligence of his audience and not taking the time to explain the arcana that he was throwing at us at 50 miles an hour. And you sort of had to work to keep up with Dennis Miller, but if you did, it was rapid fire hysteria. And the interesting thing is, he still has those qualities. I still watch him once in a while. I'll catch him on the Fox News thing, and I loved him on Saturday Night Live. I think he's arguably the best Weekend Update host they've ever had, and I loved his HBO show. And it wasn't about the politics, because even then, I've been right of center for all through those years. But the appreciation of the humor and the appreciation of the joke first. And I think you're right. I think he tries to make the ideology funny instead of trying to make the funny. And it makes a difference. And I've also lost a lot of my interest in Dennis Miller, even though I don't agree with everything he says. He's much further right than I am. But I actually agree with him a little more than I used to. But he's not nearly as funny. And I think that speaks to the point that you said before, that you have to start from the funny. Otherwise,
yeah,
there's just no interest there.
Yeah, I mean, I really wish that I could have talked to him. I mean, not just because I'm a fangirl, which I totally am, but because I really would have loved to have known where his joke writing trajectory moved. You know, I mean, from the 1990s to the 2000s. And in the 1990s, I mean, you and I can sort of both attest, you know, he took aim at everybody, which I think also is this great sort of political comedian conceit. This idea that, you know, I mean, political comedians, conservatives will say, oh, you know, John Stewart really pulled the punch on Obama. I really don't think he did, and I don't think he does right now. I think that the mark of a great political comedian is being able to go ahead and take aim at everybody. And I think that that's what Miller did best in the 1990s. I mean, oh, my God.
And he's lost that. There's no question.
Oh, he's absolutely lost it. I mean, you know, the way that he took down Newt Gingrich and you know, half of the Conservative Opportunity Society was just genius. And it wasn't because I agreed with him. He took it down Clinton, you know, in this way before Lewinsky, you know, that was just brutal. And I agreed with him. I found myself, even though I supported the Democrats, just nodding, going, "Oh my gosh, you're right." And he doesn't do that anymore. And I wish he did, because I think he's got the skills to do it. And
oh,
that's what I want a political comedian to do. You know, I read I read Will Durst now, and Andy Borowitz, and they are just as ripe to take down the liberals as they are the conservatives, you know, for just screwing up and for betraying their ideals. You know, I really think that's what comedy is supposed to do. It's supposed to say, hey, you know, we can do better than this, and this is what you're doing? Screw you. And that's what a great comedian does. I think that the conservative comedians are less want to do that, because conservatives are sort of more in line with the power structure than liberals are.
No, that's true. That's true. I want to cover one more topic, and then we'll start to wind up for the evening. There is, of course, the constant whine of bias, right? So conservatives will argue that the reason that there are no really good conservative humorists, conservative political satirists, is because the opportunity is not there, because the cards are stacked against them. You know, Hollywood and the entertainment industry and the media and all of this.
Yeah, I heard
stuff.
That a lot.
I'm sure you did. So, you know, is there? I know there's a lot of sour grapes in all of that. But is there, you know, and maybe it's a chicken and egg question, but is there something to it? Is there some bias there? I mean, whether it's mm-hmm. intentional or not, has it not evolved into something that would make it harder now for a good conservative comic to break in?
You know, I think it's a great question. My own confirmation biases notwithstanding, and I will cop to those. I really do think that more liberals are drawn to this than conservatives. But I look at a Nick DiPaolo, who I truly believe is very talented, and I also believe he was deprived opportunities because of his political leanings. I also think that he was given opportunities because of his talent. And those included, you know, Louis C.K.'s show. And now there's this great invention called YouTube, where I think that if it is funny, it will fly. And so, you know, I look to Kelsey Grammer's YouTube channel, The Right Network, which was this idea of like, okay, we're just going to show conservative programming and it'll be sort of family friendly and, you know, whatever, and we'll make $1 billion. And they just didn't. One of the guys I interviewed was Evan Sayet, who's a conservative political humorist, and he's just a super nice guy. I mean, there's no two ways about that. But his joke started with the idea that liberals are idiots, and I thought, okay, well, what's funny about that? You know, I can tell you a bunch of, like, okay, social justice-fearing, soy dog-eating, Prius-driving jokes. Like, you know, I can make fun of liberals better than your average bear. I went to UMass Amherst. I know from humorous liberals. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I can mock them as far as I can plug in their cars. So give me something that's funny. You know, it's this idea of like, oh, they just hate the country. Okay, that's not funny. Like, okay, give me something that is funny. And the answer was like, no, he kind of couldn't. And so I really genuinely believe that there are mechanisms out there that where there is humor, you can get it, you know, through viral videos, through YouTube, through a whole bunch of, like, the memes. Apparently conservatives are, like, jumping up and down on the memes, like, yay, conservatives. Like, you can do this. You know, you really can. And there's no power structure right now to stop you from doing it. And so
I don't know. I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't know if that compares with the opportunity of getting a pilot with HBO or something. I mean, DiPaolo is a really interesting case study, but it's only, and I admit it's only an ad hoc, you know, it's ad hoc. It's only a case study of one, because I've always felt that he's way outsized in talent for where his career has taken him. And I always expected that he was going to be huge. and you know, sort of almost like a Lewis Black huge, which is
right.
You know, sort of an A minus level comedian. And I know there aren't enough conservative comics out there with his kind of talent to be able to know whether or not any of that blockage is truly in place. But I'm not sure that I would equate that necessarily with the opportunity of somebody, you know, of YouTube yet.
I mean, you know what? I think that's a great point. I think that's a great point. And I really stand corrected. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. It's who's going to get a production deal at HBO or at Showtime? And when I was interviewing Nick, you know, he said that those opportunities really sort of faded away. And you're right. I really didn't give it as much credence as I probably should have. I think, though, that, you know, he sort of moved away from the comedy into more sports stuff. And he's certainly moved away from more political comedy into more sort of genial comedy. And whether that is a function of sort of these liberal gatekeepers in Hollywood, it very well may be. I mean, it's tough to say. There's a great sociologist named Herbert Gans who did this big study that showed that the sort of famous Hollywood actors were more liberal, but the people who worked behind the scenes were more conservative. So your editors and your, you know, production people were just more conservative. I'm not sure that actually does open the doors, though. And so I think it's a great point. I'm not 100% sure what to do about it if your starting off point is that a conservative is not going to want to go into Hollywood because it's so liberal anyway. And do you see what I mean? Like the point that I made was that if the drama club is like, and I'm
not implying, by the way, that you know, in my mind, I think the word gatekeeper is a stronger word than I would use. I'm reminded of a company I worked for a number of years ago, a software company, and it was started by a guy who was a software engineer, and his background was in physics and music, and he was the nicest guy, and he was an introvert.
Mm-hmm.
But he started a company, and he managed to overcome his, you know, his natural tendencies to want to sit in a corner and read a book or study and get some angel investing and start it up. But when he started hiring staff, he tended to hire in his own image. And you wouldn't know it from me, but get me off the radio, and I'm the kind of guy who likes to sit in the corner and read a book too, tend to be introverted. And pretty soon he surrounded himself with an executive team and a directorial team who were largely introverted. And we tended to design a lot of things and be very, very creative and kick around really interesting, knowledge-y kinds of wacky ideas. It took us a long time to produce anything, and we didn't sell it very well at all. And that idea, not so much that he had consciously decided that he only wanted those kinds of people, but the idea that like breeds like, and that you tend to hire in your own image, or you tend to take the meetings for people who are in your own image, that you're going to be comfortable with people who are already in your tribe, and whether or not, for whatever reason, the liberal model of humor, political humor, having grown into a more liberally oriented place, may just make it harder for conservatives to get that window of opportunity, not because they're consciously being blocked, but because the people who are already there are amused by people like them, not people like me.
It's a really, really great point. And I'm not, you know, the output of Hollywood is that 50% of the country is conservative and 50% is liberal. You know, I mean, so I think that Hollywood is just so interested in what's going to make money.
No question.
That just trumps all of it. And so I think your point is excellent, and I don't really know kind of where to go with it, except to say that if 75% of the American public, and studies show that this is a fairly sound statistic, they don't care about politics at all. I mean, you're talking about
25%. That upsets me terribly, but nevertheless.
Yeah, I mean, it you know, crushes me. I mean, 75% of the American public thinks, you know, I'm a loser? Like, that's horrible. You know, so 25% actually cares, and then you divide that in half. You're talking about, you know, 12.5% of the American public, like, thinks left, 12.5% thinks right. You know, I mean, where do you and I go from here? And then if you want to make it funny, good gravy. I mean, then we got to take all of that 12.5 out of it and just say some sweeping generalization of, oh, Congress is terrible. Ha, ha, ha. You know,
right.
I mean, and that just hangs its hat on these pre-existing ideas about who politicians are, and that's not good for democracy at all. I mean, you know, you and I want to make it funny. You and I want to keep it great. And I think we can try. I think we're speaking to a small group of people. But I guess the good news is that this small group of people actually are the ones who vote. And so as long as our arguments are sort of clean, you know, and smart and funny, I think our democracy is going to be strong.
I agree with you on that, and I do wish more people would be involved, and I certainly wish the people who are interested but perhaps not emotionally gut-wrenched to get out during primaries and things like that would also be more involved. But it's interesting when you talk about, you know, 25% who care. Many more than that obviously vote, but
not during a midterm election.
Not in midterms, absolutely not. It's the people who are really involved and who are hitting a lot of these, Haight's five triggers of moral intuition. Those people who are listening and
yep.
being triggered emotionally, who are getting out to the polls, and humor definitely has a role in doing that. There's no question about it.
I agree.
I want to thank you as we wind up. This has been a fascinating conversation for me. I've always loved humor. I always thought what it would be like to be a stand-up comic, and then realize it's really hard work.
Oh my gosh.
And terrifying work, and I've always said,
it would be awful.
Yeah, I think it would be hard too. You know, there's an interesting topic we didn't really get to, which is this idea that, you know, if you talk to major comedians, everybody from, you know, Jonathan Winters, Rest of Soul, and Robin Williams, Steve Martin, Lily Tomlin, they all tell you that a lot of humor comes from a place of pain and suffering. And I've always been curious
Absolutely.
About how that plays into, you know, why certain comedians would want to become political humorists, or whether that plays in there, what motivates people to choose that kind of humor. But perhaps that's a topic for another book, or perhaps another visit to the show. In any case, so we can talk about this forever.
I would love that.
But Allison Dagnes, I want to thank you very much. It's been a tremendously enjoyable conversation. I want to recommend everyone again the book A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. And we'll go back and take a look at some of the jokes on the that were posted on the Middle Ground. I want to read one more that I picked off that I found particularly funny. And then I'm going to give you just a few seconds to think of this as we go off the air. I want to know what your favorite political joke is. But the one that struck me today was a Conan O'Brien joke.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was from the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Mm-hmm.
The line was, I'd like to acknowledge, he says, that earlier this evening there was some confusion with the seating chart. For a moment, someone accidentally sat Governor Chris Christie with the Republicans. That was awkward, and I apologize. and that line just sort of really—it's a good example of how you can take be politically funny and not necessarily offend anyone at all. Just kind of poke at both sides, which I think what a lot of these late night comedians are able to do. You mentioned
it's
earlier,
true.
Nobody wants to lose half of their audience, and I thought that particular joke was one of those brilliant ones. It just, you know, it's like Solomon slicing the baby; just everybody would laugh at it. So very quickly, tell me, have you got one off the top of your head that was a particular favorite?
Actually, from the most recent Correspondents' Dinner, President Obama said that he wanted to really reach across the aisle and go out hunting with Rand Paul and go out fishing with Marco Rubio and do book burnings with Michelle Bachmann. And I thought that was pretty genius.
That's actually a pretty bold joke.
It really was. But at the same time, I mean, think about it this way. You know, Michelle Bachmann is not particularly popular, and the other two are.
That's true.
So
and I'm okay
who
with
is that going
that,
to appeal to? all the liberals and half the conservatives. So 75% of the audience, that ain't a bad showing.
That's not a bad showing at all. Thank you again, Allison Dagnes. Very much appreciate
thank
you
so
being
much.
On the middle ground. Thank you. And good night, everyone. Just a quick word. I'm going to be on hiatus now through the end of June. Starting next week, the show, of course, will go on. Eric Byler will be here with an array of revolving co-hosts for the next month and a half. I will be back right around the beginning of July. So all of you enjoy the next upcoming shows. Thank you again to our guests tonight, and to all of you, a good evening. Thanks very much.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the middle ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on the middle ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be free.